Alaska has some of the highest healthcare costs in the world. One solution lawmakers are considering right now is an initiative aimed at reducing unnecessary emergency room visits. I'm Annie Feit. The proposal is part of a Medicaid reform bill, and it's the result of a collaboration between state hospitals, emergency room physicians, and the State Health and Social Services Department. It's our topic today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Nearly 10,000 Alaskans have connected with the Salmon Project, sharing their passion for salmon all across the state. Join the growing family of people united by the love for this resource and the unique Alaskan ways of life. Visit salmonlife.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
The state has identified more than 12,000 Alaskans in the Medicaid program who are super utilizers of hospital emergency rooms. That's someone who makes at least three ER visits in a single year. Super utilizers represent a little less than 10% of the Medicaid recipients, but they're a big cost driver for the program. An initiative making its way through the state legislature would help patients get the care they need in a less expensive setting. I have a great group of healthcare experts here to discuss the proposal. And we have Julie Taylor. She's CEO of Alaska Regional Hospital in Anchorage. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
And Dr. Ann Zink is an ER physician at Matsu Regional Hospital in Palmer. She's also president of the Alaska chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. That's a mouthful. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good to be here.
Thanks for being here. And Becky Hultberg is president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Hi, Becky.
Good morning.
And Becky, I wanted to start with you. Can you kind of give us an explanation of where the idea for this initiative came from?
Sure. Happy to do it. And thanks for having us here today. I think this is a great topic to be discussing, and it's very timely given the bill in the legislature right now. So just a little bit of background on the issue. Washington State had its own version of a budget crisis a couple of years ago, and perhaps not as deep as ours, but nevertheless, there was a lot of discussion about how are we going to manage the Medicaid budget, which is, of course, a big part of any state budget. And Washington decided they were going to limit the number of emergency room visits that they paid for. So they were only going to pay for three emergency room visits a year. Well, and you'll hear from I'm sure, Julie and Dr. Zink and others, there are people in emergency rooms potentially over 100 times a year. So hospitals sued over that. And a result of actually what was an uncomfortable situation, a lawsuit, was the collaboration that hospitals, physicians, and the state work together to find a better way to manage emergency room costs. And the program is called ER is for Emergencies, or Seven Best Practices, some different names. But basically, it's implementing seven best practices in emergency room management and trying to connect people who are using the emergency room as their source of primary care with better resources to help them.
And Dr. Zink, when you first heard about this initiative, you're someone who actually works in the ER. What was your impression?
Yeah, no, great question. I initially heard about this from what was happening in Washington State with colleagues who were there. There was a bill, federal bill, passed in 1986 called EMTALA that requires us to see and do a medical screening exam on every single patient who presents to an emergency department 24/7, 365, regardless of their chief complaint. And so my colleagues in Washington had a lot of concern over limiting who was going to be paid and who they could potentially see and what that would do to access and care to patients. And just as Becky mentioned, this collaboration built a system that to me kind of feels like apple pie. It's basic good medicine that allowed physicians to provide better care to patients. Patient outcomes improved, patients were satisfied, the hospital saved money, and the physicians felt like they were able to provide better care. And that's what made me initially very excited about learning more about Washington did, collaborating with Washington, and seeing if we could bring the same thing to Alaska to provide better care, as well as providing access to an emergency department that is critically important for traumas, for heart attacks, for all sorts of different medical issues that come up, yet being able to do it in a way that is compassionate and coordinated.
And Julie Taylor, you're CEO of one of the big hospitals in Anchorage. What was your initial impression of this? Did you have concerns?
Not at all. I was actually very excited. And this is my fourth state in holding a hospital leadership role. And I also have a background as a nurse and a case manager. So this is something that's pervasive across the U.S. and certainly an opportunity for us to get involved at the grassroots levels, because there are very specific things that we can put in place that can change the behavior that's driving what's happening now.
Okay, and I want to invite callers to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, please dial 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And we also have Health Commissioner Valerie Davidson joining us from Juneau. Hi, Val.
Good morning.
And can you kind of give me, like, how did this, give me your impression of this? How did the state first pick up this idea?
So I think it was echoing a lot of what the other speakers spoke about. I'm going to move this mic because I'm having an echo. Apologize. So really, we really saw that a lot of Alaskans weren't really utilizing healthcare in the most appropriate setting. And when folks just use the emergency room for their care, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are getting the appropriate care in the appropriate setting at the appropriate time. So they may be seen for something that could be taken care of with a primary care physician or their community health aide or a nurse practitioner, et cetera.
Okay, and Becky, can you get, you know, you talked about this is Alaska's version of the 7 best practices. Give us like the top 3 that this legislation hits on.
I'll give you the top 3 from my perspective, and then maybe we can ask Anne what her top 3 is. I they may be the same, but from a practitioner standpoint, it may be a little different. I think the three top areas, from my perspective, are the electronic information exchange. This puts in place a system that pushes data to the ER physician. It's very brief data that includes their recent history in other emergency departments, but it's the data that a physician would really need, and again, I'll defer to Anne on this, but would need to see that patient, the relevant information to treat that patient at that time. But it's a push system, not a login, try to figure out how to get to the information you need. So it's very timely. The second piece is the care coordination. If you're going to help people to identify where is the best location for them to get care, you have to actually connect them to that location. They may not know, because many times if they knew how to get care in a more appropriate care setting, they would do it. So it actually connects them to that care. And then the third piece is something that we've been talking about in the legislature through other bills, this bill and others, and that's narcotic guidelines. It implements narcotic guidelines in the emergency department so that there's a consistent way that we're handling the prescription of narcotics throughout facilities. And that specifically, there's not a large volume of narcotics prescribed through emergency rooms anyway. But it's important that we're managing that problem at every opportunity. And this is one place where I think putting in some guidelines in place really has made a difference in Washington. I think they saw almost a 25% reduction in opioid prescriptions out of the emergency rooms through those guidelines. So that's my top 3.
Dr. Zink, did you have something to add to that?
No, I would echo what Becky said. I think the most important thing is the communication back and forth between the hospital, some sort of electronic medical record, as well as the case coordination. I oftentimes feel as an emergency physician, I'm being asked to practice blind and handcuffed. I don't know if they just were seen at Alaska Regional. I don't know if they were just seen at Providence. They may have had 10 CTs this last month, and I don't know that information if the patient isn't forthcoming and telling me that information. I also don't know if they've received numerous prescriptions. I had a patient yesterday. He had 30 different prescriptions from 20 providers in the last year. I would have never guessed in a million years, but have made it a practice style to look up anyone before I discharge them with narcotics to take a look, just so I'm not judging patients. I'm just trying to get information. And so I think that this bill really allows us to have the information to be able to make better decisions about patient care. So I think that that is really the meat behind both what's in SB 74 as well as the 7 best practices. And then the secondary aspects are being able to review it, being able to work together as a process on the outside, being able to create guidelines. But the key component of this is rapid access to information exchange and robust care coordination so that we're being able to utilize outpatient resources, inpatient resources to provide wraparound services for these patients. Mental health is a huge component in Washington State. They found that 89% of these people had mental health problems and approximately 41% had addiction issues. The Mattsu Health Foundation data is a little bit less than that. It's about 56% had behavioral health issues of patients who were frequent flyers. And so these are complex patients that need a lot of resources and allows us to have access to those.
And Commissioner Davidson, can you weigh in on this aspect of it? What does the state know about who these super utilizers of the ER are? Are they people who are having trouble accessing primary care? Do they have a lot of mental health issues potentially? What do we know about this population?
So it really is a mix. And right now, we think we've identified about 12,000 people who've utilized the emergency room more than three times, perhaps inappropriately. And what we really see is typically in states that don't have a comprehensive continuum of behavioral health, a comprehensive behavioral health system, you will see rises in three different kinds of experiences. First is the number of people who are overutilizing emergency departments, and it's pretty simple. If you don't have access to a behavioral health provider, then you can go to the emergency room because, as Dr. Zink said, because of the federal EMTALA law, it is the one place you can legally go that cannot turn you away. We also see increased rates in child maltreatment, and we also see increases in the number of individuals who are having contact with public safety or the number of inmates in corrections. And unfortunately, in our state, it's ding, 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 all three. And so one of the things that I appreciate about the Senate Bill 74 that's moving its way through the legislature is really an opportunity to revamp and redesign our behavioral health system so that it works for Alaskans. I think that the system is really something that developed over time. It certainly isn't the fault of any one person. It isn't the fault of providers. It isn't the fault of the state. It's something that has developed over time, and Alaska, like other states, is looking at, you know, now that we are where we are in our point in history, is this a system that we want, a system that works for us? We certainly see that the numbers of Alaskans who are dealing with opioid addiction of some type have really increased about four times over the last 10 years. In 2015, just based upon our preliminary analysis, 88 Alaskans died of an opioid overdose. And while only 34 of those died of heroin overdose, 54 Alaskans died of a prescription pain reliever overdose. And so we know that we have to get a handle on opioids, and including prescriptions. And what's really worrying, though, is that for every opioid death, 12 people are admitted for opioid abuse or an overdose, and 25 are evaluated in the emergency department. So for every 12 deaths, we have an additional, 37 people who are needing additional care.
And Dr. Zink, does that match what you see in your practice?
To me, it's almost an underrepresentation. The amount of narcotic abuse that we see and heroin abuse that we see is astronomical. It's devastating. You meet well-dressed, healthy, nice people who have jobs and are doing well, and they come in. I had a patient yesterday in tears saying, I need help to deal with my heroin problem. It's not that I can't afford it. I have a great job, but I'm using somewhere between a gram and a half a day, and it's controlling my life. It's a huge issue. A lot of times, 80% of people who use heroin started with prescription drugs at some point, so it is a huge health risk, and it's a big public health issue. It's not that narcotics should not be used. They have their role, and treating pain is an essential component of being able to compassionately care for people. However, we need to make sure that we're doing it in an evidence-based and rational way.
So specifically, what does this initiative do to address the drug?
Yeah.
abuse component?
Three different things. So as Becky mentioned, it helps to kind of solidify guidelines between all of us. So in the emergency department, I'm here to take care of emergent, acute, life-threatening issues. So I'm not going to be refilling someone's chronic pain medication. So it really sets specific guidelines and allows us to all be consistent with it. It also allows me to have better and easier access to the prescription drug database. So I'm able to see if someone already has a lot of narcotics that are being written for, or they're shopping around between different providers. Or maybe I think that they are and I look them up and they've never received a narcotic before. I'm going to be more liberal in writing that patient and say these have risk of addiction and they have risk of constipation and other issues, but I see that you haven't received any other narcotics from anyone else in the last 2 years. This must really be hurting you, so let's go ahead and address your pain. It takes away the judgment. It takes the judgment out of it and allows me to objectively see a patient and see their history and be able to address it. And then the third thing is case coordination and care coordination. So if I have a patient who's repeatedly coming into the emergency department saying if they don't get their narcotics, they're going to kill themselves, and they're having to go to API 5, 6, 7 times a year, that's a huge expense on the hospital system, on the state system, but that patient is manipulating to be able to get narcotics. And if we can create a better care plan for that patient so that they're not just bouncing between physicians to get narcotics, ending up in API, being released, then being taken back into custody, intermittently going to jail, it's just a really expensive way to deal with an addiction. And it's not helping the patient. That patient's struggling and that patient's hurting, and I want to help that patient, but the system that we have now isn't helping them, and we need to help that patient in a different way.
And Julie, did you have something to add here?
Yes. Well, I think to give a little context around these kind of patients, you also have the population that have a comorbidity along with a heroin addiction. So they might have a cardiomyopathy that when they come in with chest pain, they have to do a complete workup every single time because it could very well be, this could be the big one that they would die from. And having that care coordination and the ability to share that information is really critical to our success. I had a case back in Idaho where a patient came in, and this is very similar to what we see in this state, where she was end-stage renal failure, had a history of chest pain that we thought was always going to be the one that was going to be the one to take her life. And twice a month, she would come in with this chest pain, and we had to do a complete workup every single time because her spouse is there saying, she's the mother of my child. You can't let her die. I know that she's, you know, very ill. And we do these, you know, thousands and thousands of dollar workups, knowing that one time it was going to be right. And eventually it was. But without an ability to give her support and wrap care planning around her, and that's the case management piece I wanted to speak to, because these people have learned behaviors. And without the social network to help them prop up and do things the way they need to and access those resources, they're going to fall back into this same system. And so what I think is really powerful about what this provides is that care management component.
And is that something that, we've heard a lot about case management in the healthcare world in the last, 5 years or so. Is it something that's kind of catching on? And even though it's extra effort, it pays dividends?
What it's done, because I'm old case manager, so I can speak to this personally. And in the, years past, it was inside the walls of the hospital. And what's happening now, as we're moving outside the walls of the hospital and looking more broadly about the system pieces that need to come together to keep them out of the hospital. And what we see in our emergency department are patients that we wish we would have caught 2 weeks ago and got them into a primary care visit so that the issue that we're dealing with now doesn't put them in ICU, like an abscess tooth that has now created a sepsis that needs to be managed internally. So being able to have enough care coordination outside the walls of the hospital is a big piece of this, and that's infrastructure that needs to be put in place.
Yeah, and Commissioner Davidson, do you want to weigh in here? I know care coordination is a topic that you are in favor of and have spoken highly of.
Sure, absolutely. So one of the things that we really appreciate about Senate Bill 74 is really the broad reform authority that is included in the bill that includes opportunities for care management or case management, making sure that we can partner with our providers to really make sure that individual Alaskans get the care that they need in the appropriate setting and in the right way. The really broad reform authority and the flexibility that's available in the bill is something that will serve Alaska really well, because states that do health reform do it constantly. It's not go across the room and flip on a light switch and you're done. It states that do it well are constantly evolving and constantly improving. And so some of the things that are in this bill are things that are lessons learned from other states, whether it's different kinds of pay for performance kinds of opportunities, different ways to be able to pay for services, whether it's care management, et cetera, are really things that we have learned from other states. And as those things happen in other states and also through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Innovation Center, we want to be able to use those opportunities to improve healthcare in Alaska without having to first stop at the legislature and say, okay, we need to amend state law so that we can do what other states are doing in ways that are improving the health of our population. So that flexibility is really, really helpful.
Okay, and this, in terms of the ER initiative specifically, the Medicaid redesign project identified some potential savings in the first year. Is that correct?
Yes. So with the fiscal notes that are available through the public-private partnership that's described in the bill, it would save about $1 million a year.
Okay. And so we're not, you know, when we're talking about a $4 billion deficit, that, you know, maybe doesn't sound like a lot, but is that actually significant? I don't know, Commissioner Davidson, do you want to address that? Or?
Well, I think given our budget environment, quite frankly, we'll take every dollar that we can get in savings. And as you add up those savings, I think what you will see is that it will make a significant impact. I know for Senate Bill 74, just the provisions included in that bill, we would save about a little over $31 million in general fund in FY17. And through the sixth year of implementation for the reform efforts in FY22, those savings would increase to about $113.5 million. So those are not small savings. Those are pretty significant.
Okay.
When we're talking about changing behavior, we have to make sure that we are not, you know, over projecting what we can happen. So I completely agree with the commissioner that I would rather under promise and over deliver. And when we think about our Mountain View clinic that we're putting in now this summer over in just to the north of us in Mountain View, I think that's going to have savings immediately for the state on of its own, because we have patients being seen in our emergency department that have no business being there. But when the clinic, the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Clinic, moved to their new location, which is wonderful and serves a lot of people, there's still that group of 5,000 that take the bus to my ER. And I want them to be able to have that health care that they need in their home community. And I believe that will generate savings there and also hopefully get in front of things before they wait till they need emergency room to be seen for the issue that they're putting off.
And so that will open this summer?
Yep. Our plans are to have that open by July.
And I think Julie raised a really good point, and that is, you know, care coordination is only effective if you have the ability outside the hospital walls to provide the care. And so I think that will be a key thing as we move forward with this project that we need to continuously evaluate. I mean, Julie's identified a need in a neighborhood that accesses her hospital and is, you know, filling that need. But I think as we move forward, we're going to get better at identifying where care gaps are as we try to connect people who are emergency room utilizers with the appropriate care in the outpatient setting. And I hope that is seamless and that the care is available and that is easy. And I suspect it will not be that way.
And again, I have to emphasize, this is behavior that we change, human behavior. And in a society where if I need it now, I want it now, and I'm going to get it now, and I've waited till the last minute, now it is an emergency for me, that is something that takes time to change. And by having that service resource available, you know, as easily, I think it's going to be a big part of our being able to be successful long term.
Okay, and I want to invite callers into the mix one more time. We're talking about ER use and an initiative that would curb unnecessary ER use that's going through the legislature right now. The call-in number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, you can call 550-8422 or email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And Dr. Zink, you wanted to...
Yeah, I just wanted to echo what had been said. I think that the emergency department, to me, reminds me of, you know, kind of like a big catch net under a bunch of trapeze acts. Most of the time it goes well, but sometimes the surgeon's out of town and can't follow up with that patient. Sometimes they don't have the social support network that they need. And you have to have a way to be able to pick that patient up and be able to get there. And we're there to be that net, but it's got to be collaborative. And one of the things that I have just immensely enjoyed in my role, both as ASAP president as well as the medical director, is learning about all of the incredible community service activities and programs that are out there to help people and to be able to connect those better. So I just came from a care coordination meeting that's happening out in Mat-Su on a regular basis. And it's fascinating that I didn't, you know that this organization existed and they didn't know another organization existed. And just by being able to have this conversation, and I believe that this bill really supports that conversation, we can utilize the resources that are out there and figure out which ones we need to build. But there's already so many great people in this community working really hard to provide these services out there. This just provides a way to be able to connect those and pick those people up that are falling through the gaps and find the right place for them.
So explain, you know, what happens at a care coordination meeting like you were at this morning.
Yeah, so there's different ways to do it. So we are currently not discussing individual patients. We're more discussing what services are available, who's doing what's happening, what sort of resources you have. So if a patient comes in and I realize that they need housing, they are elderly and need to be connected to outpatient social services and be able to have transportation, I know who to refer them to. Our social worker knows who to refer them to, and vice versa. An example from this morning is that the state has funded a call-in care expert plan. It's called MedExpert, that will do case management via the phone. But our behavioral health team that does all of our behavioral health assessments didn't realize that that existed and just went to a conference where they felt like that would be a really good way to engage their clients. So there's an example of people working in the community, working hard to do it, and not realizing that the state had provided a service to do it. And so simply by having that conversation, they're like, oh, I will go ahead and use that, and we will start to try to utilize those services. So that's an example of just being able to have this conversation where I think that a lot of the savings are going to happen. And while this is only a small amount initially, I believe it's just the beginning of what can be saved, and that's what Washington has found. This has just grown and grown as they've been able to identify areas that need help, who's doing what, what's being able to happen, and being able to move forward. It just provides an area for that communication.
And I think a key thing that, Dr. Zink just touched on is that we think about care coordination as linking people with a medical provider or a behavioral health provider, and that is often the case. But sometimes the barrier may not be lack of access. The barrier to the medical provider or to them accessing a medical provider may be transportation. It mm-hmm. may be homelessness. It may be some other social issue. And so when we're talking about resources available in the community that we need to either connect people to or gaps we need to fill, it may be the availability of a medical or behavioral health provider, but it also may be the ability to access transportation, the ability to find a safe place to live. And so it's connecting all of those things together, because those social support networks are a really important component of someone's health as well.
And Commissioner Davidson, what do you think about that piece of this? Because you're in charge of a huge department in the state that is, you know, in charge of a lot of these different aspects, safety net aspects. How do you get those different parts talking more about what they're doing and collaborating more? Is that a part of this for you?
Sure it is. So the other piece that I think is important that's different, because we do have a super utilizer program that we have employed. It's a state-run program. We hire a contractor to be able to do that work for us, but it is a voluntary program. One of the things that's included in this bill that we've been talking about is a program that is a public-private partnership that is a mandatory program. And the thing that I really love about this opportunity is it's not the state doing this by itself or our contractor. It's really a collaborative effort that we're really counting on folks at the community level to really help us to identify the resources that are available to Alaskans. You know, one of the challenges we have is, as you said, we are a large department. And quite frankly, I'll be honest, we can use all the help we can get. We know that there are Alaskans who are not able to access the services that we know that they need. One of the other components of the bill that I think is really critical to being able to make the kind of progress we need to as a state is the behavioral health improvement opportunity. Because quite frankly, no matter what we do with care coordination, no matter what we do with emergency room utilization or overutilization, or pick whatever kind of word you want to use, if we identify somebody who needs treatment services but we don't have a program to refer them to, then we have done ourselves a huge disservice. And so we really see the behavioral health aspects and the other social services aspects as a critical part to being able to change and improve healthcare for Alaskans.
And are there a lot of barriers to getting that behavioral health piece into this right now?
Well, yes, there are some, and some of them have been identified in the bill. One is right now, if you want to be able to bill Medicaid for behavioral health, you have to have a behavioral health grant from the state. So, you know, at a time that probably made a lot of sense. Now, does it make sense necessarily? Not really. But we also have to proceed carefully and make sure that there's a balance, because the behavioral health grantees do have some requirements, administrative requirements as a part of their grantee requirements. And quite frankly, some of those I think are more burdensome than they need to be. And so we're looking at streamlining some of those so that they don't have to be overly burdensome. And at the same time, if we open the door to folks who are not required to have a behavioral health grant, then they may not have as many requirements. So how do we make sure that we impose some requirements on folks so that we have a level playing field? So that the folks who don't have a grant are suddenly at an advantage of folks who, quite frankly, have been really dedicated to improving behavioral health services in our state. So yeah, there are lots of opportunity. I'll be the first to admit we have lots of room for improvement.
Okay, well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll hear more about this emergency room initiative as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit, and today we're talking about emergency room use and an initiative that's in the legislature right now that would work to curb unnecessary emergency room use. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call, 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, dial 550-8422 or email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. My guests today are Health Commissioner Valerie Davidson, joining us from Juneau. Julie Taylor is CEO of Alaska Regional Hospital in Anchorage. Dr. Ann Zink is an ER physician at Matsu Regional Hospital. And Becky Hultberg is president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. And we do have a caller on the line who I want to bring into the conversation now. Catherine, hello.
Hi, I'm here.
Do you have a question?
No, I have a suggestion. One of the doctors was saying that people were taking the bus to the ERs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're putting in a facility in Mountain View, I was just wondering if they could provide vouchers or some sort of ride for people who are in need of going to the healthcare facility as opposed to going to the ER. If they could make that part of the plan.
Okay.
To help.
Yeah,
I think that would be a great suggestion when we look at how grants are used for the state, and especially if there's grants available to support community organizations like what we're doing. I think that would be a great, great way to make a resource available.
And Commissioner Davidson, is that something that you've looked at in your department?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? Because I didn't have audio for...
Oh, sorry. The caller was wondering if it was possible to have transportation vouchers to get to, like, the Mountain View Clinic that Alaska Regional is setting up, or I assume to Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. Just if transportation is a barrier.
Others... I'm sorry. So other states, I think, as they're designing their care management programs, have included transportation vouchers as a way to increase access to care, especially for improving their access to primary care. And I mean, that's certainly something that we would be interested in. For the projects that are available through the bill, there are a number of opportunities for folks to either do accountable care organizations or a variety of different kinds of care coordination opportunities that we're going to be looking for proposals to propose solutions that are really very creative, and this would certainly be an opportunity that could be included.
It'd be a perfect thing for a case manager to coordinate for that patient. Yeah. I mean, that's case by case basis, yes.
Okay. And Commissioner Davidson, can you talk about how collaborative this process has been with the legislature and with lawmakers? In general, you know, I know it passed the Senate, this legislation, has the reception been good?
Well, this legislation has actually been around, at least in some form, for a little over a year. Senate Bill 74, which is Senator Kelly's bill, and then Senate Bill 78, which was the administration's proposal, Governor Walker's bill, have been in existence for some time. There are other provisions of the bill, like telehealth, which got added in Senate Finance, which was a telemedicine piece. But I think they've done a really good job of having a lot of hearings. I think in the Senate Finance Committee, I think there were 16 hearings in which they received a lot of expert testimony, including from actually, I think, all three of the folks who are all four of us actually sat at the table providing testimony in some way or another. And I think they did a really great job of managing the information. There are some tweaks that happened along the way as concerns were addressed. And, you know, I think we'll see a little bit more of that happening now that the bill is in House Finance. The bill is scheduled for hearings all this week as well as all next week. And there will be an opportunity for public testimony. I think that will be scheduled sometime next week, so folks can check the legislative calendar that's posted on Friday to see what date that bill has been scheduled.
Okay, and Dr. Zink, what has this process been like for you trying to communicate with lawmakers about this part of the bill?
Yeah, it's been actually an amazing process and a really great process. As I mentioned earlier, the collaboration has been one of the most rewarding parts of the job even prior to this. And it was really rewarding to testify. I felt like the Senate asked really good questions. I think there's oftentimes a misunderstanding about what the emergency department is, and what we do is perceived as very expensive and costly. It's only 4% of the total healthcare dollars, but provides this big safety net. And there's a lot of concerns of, why can't you just tell that patient that they're not going to come? That was a specific question that I got. And it was a great chance to educate about EMTALA and what we do. And I felt as though the Senate was incredibly receptive to our concerns and very collaborative in creating a system that met the intentions of what we were hoping for while not having unburdened restrictions, and has been overall a very uplifting and positive experience. To me, this sort of legislation only makes sense and has been something that I've been hoping would come to fruition for a really long time. And it was neat to partner with our legislators in moving forward.
Okay. And we have another caller on the line, Jane from Copper Basin. Hello. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. First comment would be, for these people that misuse the emergency rooms habitually, that claim not to have the money to go to a regular doctor, why not put the deductible that they would be charged and put that against their PFDs? Because if they do have some financial responsibility for these repeat visits that are not necessary, and it affected their PFD dividend, then perhaps that would reduce their number of visits. And on the other side of the coin, for those of us who rarely go to the emergency room, perhaps 2-3 times in a lifetime, and if you're sent there by your own physician because possibly there's a heart issue or something else going on, what can we do to get further up the queue in front of the people that are the habitual misusers? And I'd like to take your answer off the line. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Davidson, did you hear that question? Were you able to hear that question?
I did.
Okay. And what do you have a response to the idea of basically some type of copay for people who repeatedly come to the ER?
Sure. So our Medicaid program in Alaska actually does have a limited number of copays as allowed by federal law. I know the issue was addressed yesterday in House Finance by Senator Kelly's staff, as well as by Representative Guerra, that, you know, a lot of times when we impose copays, it's actually the provider that ends up eating the cost, because trying to get that copay from somebody, quite frankly, who doesn't have any resources can be a real challenge. I think what we're talking about today, though, and the greatest opportunity in this bill is to really be proactive and to really incentivize using a carrot and really improving the service and teaching people a new way of accessing healthcare. And this includes people who've never really had health coverage before. Right now, in our state, thanks to Medicaid expansion, we have about 13,000 Alaskans who are now enrolled in Medicaid expansion, and the Medicaid program has paid out about $50 million in claims through the month of February. So, you know, we have an opportunity. You can choose a carrot, you can choose a stick, and I think what we are interested in doing as a state is really looking at our comprehensive way that we deliver healthcare, working with our providers, working with the emergency departments, working with our social supports to really provide, to really change the way that we access healthcare for Alaskans in ways that can improve their lives, in ways, quite frankly, that dinging them on their permanent fund dividend isn't necessarily going to do.
And Dr. Zink, do you want to take the second part of that question? Maybe just talk generally about how you decide who is seen in the ER and what order.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to actually address both. So for the queue component, so every hospital uses a triage system, and it's usually a level 1 to 5, and that's pretty much become the national standard. And it has to do with patients' chief complaint, their age, and their vitals. And that's based on data. Patient who presents to the emergency department who's over the age of 65 with abdominal pain has a higher mortality than a trauma 1 activation. So those patients get moved back quickly because they have a high risk of mortality. And so despite your patient, your physician sending you in or something else, we have to go based on acuity first. And so every hospital does a triage system, and we move those patients back. All of the hospitals work with their outpatient networks. So we have a system where an outpatient physician can call in and say, I'm sending this patient in, this is what I'm concerned about. And that helps us to kind of move that patient along and get them addressed. So that physician advocation can make a big difference for that. When we look at the data from the frequent utilizers, these aren't people with coughs and colds, and they're not people who are just here for pregnancy tests or other misperceptions that are in the public. These are oftentimes complex patients with multiple behavioral health issues as well as substance abuse issues. And as, you know, Julie had mentioned previously, someone who comes in with shortness of breath may think it's no big deal. And if there's a significant deductible for them to be seen, I've seen too many cases to count where patients have put off accessing healthcare because they're afraid of a copay or they're afraid of being able to pay too much of it. And they come in and their heart attack happened 4 days ago. And now they're in heart failure and they have no heart function left. And this patient's going to be crippled because of it. Another example is the child with fever. You know, we see children with fever all night long, and most of them are fine. But I've seen numerous kids with meningitis and other debilitating diseases that a parent can't always know that that's the situation that's going on. And that's why I went to medical school, and that's why I did training, is to try to figure out which of those patients are super sick and which of those patients can safely go home. And so I don't think we should put that burden, that responsibility, always on a patient to make a medical decision if this is emergent or not. It should be a layperson's decision if they think it's emergent, and it should be my decision as a medical provider that, yes, this is emergent, or nope, this is safe to go home and you can follow up with your primary care provider. And that's what the emergency department's there for, and that ultimately saves us money.
And there is a piece of this that's education too, right, that to tell people this is appropriate use of the ER and this maybe not. Do one of you want to address that part?
I think there's definitely a component, and there's one of the 7 best practices about helping educate people about the appropriate use of the emergency room. But I think Julie made a good point earlier, which is this is about behavior change. And when people know that their emergency room is always open, it is always a place they can get care whenever they need it, and they don't necessarily... If they don't have the resources to go somewhere else, they know that they can access care there without having to pay for it, then it's going to be a process of helping people to change their behavior. And that is not, education is a piece of that, but it's really even beyond education. Mm-hmm. It's really about incentives. It's really about assistance. It's about someone connecting them to the, you know, to the right resources. It sounds like for people that, you know, have transportation and have access to a primary care physician, it sounds like a very intuitive thing to do. Well, I know I just need to go to my primary care doctor. But if you don't have transportation, if you don't know who your doctor is, you need someone to help connect those dots.
The other point I'd like to make is that that copay amount only matters if you can really afford it.
Right.
So if I can write a check for $200 and I'm okay with that, that's fine. But if I don't have the money, I know I can go and I'd be seen anyway. So, and what you'll learn about people when their behavior is that the degree of which they care completely ends the minute it's no longer their financial responsibility. Like, end of the year, our OR is busy because everybody's with their co-payments for the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, how do you create incentives so people are looking at the healthcare experience and how to leverage that to their benefit as opposed to, you know, well, I don't have to pay for it anymore, so I'm going to do it this way. And that's not saying that everybody does it that way, but it does play into people's decision-making process. And again, if I can't pay $5, $50, or $200, none of it matters. But if, as Dr. Zink was saying, if they put it off, it's worse. And the patients that we have come in and are screened and given a prescription for an antibiotic and are sent home are the least of my worries. I will do that all day long. It doesn't really cost the state that much either because the amount for that visit is pretty small when you think about it would cost to get them, you know, 2 weeks down the line with a super infection and they're in the ICU.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that I worry about are the ones that are putting care off and delaying that treatment and then not having the social network to get them back into the primary care circle that they need so that they can be managed appropriately. That is where the expense falls completely, you know, outside the realm of understanding. There were two patients in Denver that I dealt with specifically, both abscessed teeth, and both ended up in ICU septic. And one was like a $750,000 bill, 6 months in an ICU, and another one was just short of $1 million. And all from an abscess tooth mm-hmm. that you could have caught earlier. But if you don't make that healthcare easily accessible and at least put a way to evaluate that early on in the process, it gets delayed. And once they're emergency room, they make one emergency room visit, fine, and then you help them get set up.
Dr. Jay Butler made a great comment, and he said, make the right choice be the easy choice. And I feel like this legislation is the first step in doing that and making the right choice be the easy choice so that the patient can get their dental care that they need rather than becoming septic. No one wants to end up in that situation.
Yeah. Okay, we have another caller, Thomas from Anchorage. Hello.
Hi. I guess you covered a lot of everything I wanted to say.
Okay.
You've almost ruined my call, but I'll come up with a comment about when I took a patient to the emergency room at a Native hospital, and what's on TV is Fox News where they're screaming at each other. And I thought it was really inappropriate. And with those kind of valuable resources, welcome to the emergency room. If you're homeless and you have a problem, pick up the phone in 9172. And then they show pictures of successful Alaskans, Olympians and stuff, where they're doing wonderful things, interrupted by another commercial. If you're not really having an emergency room, you could give a lot of information and intersperse it with pleasant, relaxing things. When you're feeling like you want to die, you don't want to hear people screaming at each other that Clinton's this and so-and-so's that. And so I think televisions in the emergency room could be used to persuade patients to go one way or another as well. That's just an idea.
Okay.
I think you make a great point, and I think that this is a step in trying to work on education. Stanford Hospital has this system where when you check in, you give them your ID and you get an iPad, and it's full of patient education and information, and then you mm-hmm. can sit there and entertain yourself and learn all about why you should not be smoking and the effects of obesity and healthy eating. And so I think in general, our system has a long way to go to educate patients and to be able to use that time while you're waiting to get that overall wraparound healthcare. I feel like we've been so overwhelmed with just trying to deal with the acute emergencies, but I think it makes a great point in continuing the education process.
Okay, and we have to take one last quick break here, but we'll hear more on this topic as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit, and today we're talking about an initiative that would curb inappropriate ER use. It's legislation going through the legislature right now. If you want to join the conversation, call 1-800-478-8255 or from Anchorage 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're talking about this initiative as part of the Medicaid reform bill. But will other patients benefit as well? Do you have to be on Medicaid to take advantage of this?
No, I mean, this. One of the benefits of this program is that it's not going that it's going to affect all patients. It's going to benefit all patients coming in the emergency department. I mean, they're not going. It's not going to be a system where you triage who's a Medicaid patient and only do this for the Medicaid patients. So I think it's easy to quantify the benefit to the Medicaid patients because often states have access to that data. But I think it would definitely improve care for everyone who's visiting the emergency department.
I'd agree. I think that if you were looking at electronic health record as an example, we have the same one that Providence does. So our physicians are already looking at patients that are shared between the campus, and they aren't looking just on the Medicaid ones. They're looking at everyone. But imagine the care coordination that happens and, oh, you had a CAT scan over at Providence 3 days ago. Let's pull that up and see what that says and compare to what's happening now. So every patient's going to see the benefit of that.
And Dr. Zink, talk about that. You called it a push system. I think of push notifications on my smartphone, which I'm constantly saying, no, don't do that to me. But you were saying that's a good thing. So talk a little bit more about exactly how this would work.
Anytime you bring up health records or electronic information in healthcare, you get a lot of response and a lot of emotion. And this is a system that allows you to be able to see the information without clicking through 10 million different things or learning a new electronic system. So there's an ER phrase, 5 clicks to crazy. And there is something about how many clicks you have to do to be able to access something and how difficult that can be. So this is a system that the state can set up on what are their preset requirements. So is it ER visits in the last year? What's in the prescription drug database? And do they have care management plans? So we can kind of set up beforehand what we want in there. And then if a patient registers to Matsu Regional, it may be a fax system. So as soon as they register in, it faxes to me, and then that's on the chart. And they'll say, oh, here's this patient, and they were seen at these other places. I had a patient the other day who had wristbands from Alaska Regional, Providence, Native, in our hospital, all on her wrist.
Wow.
From her one day of care. But she didn't tell us any of that. And it was only when we undressed her that we saw all these wristbands on. So this would allow us to have push information to be able to have access to those records rapidly and accessible without me learning a new electronic medical record system. It kind of helps to achieve what the whole goal was between electronic medical record system was to be able to have this information and be able to share it through systems. It may be something that's an electronic button within the Epic system. So for them, it wouldn't be paper. But if I'm working out in Kotzebue, if I'm working in Fairbanks as well, it could be a push system. So I know that patient just left Anchorage and here's the additional information or vice versa. So it's an easy to access. It doesn't require physicians to log in and have 7 more clicks. It's concise. It's short. It's an adjunct to the already existent electronic medical record system that allows it to be easily accessible and rapidly accessible.
And you were saying that this is something that other states are very interested in. Maybe not a ton of states have implemented it so far.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's done in Washington State. It's done in Oregon now. With Oregon, they actually then also import the data into the primary care. So then the primary care doesn't have to look up, did that patient go to the ER? What were they seeing? What was the diagnosis? It's all kind of integrated there. It's happening in West Virginia as well. And a national conference that I went to in emergency medicine back in October, this was the complete talk of the entire nation. As a nation, as Julie mentioned before, this is not isolated to Alaska. This is a huge issue. The emergency department is that safety net, and being able to have exchange of information makes a gigantic difference in our ability to care for patients. And there is a push to now make this a national-wide effort. And it's been exciting to see Alaska on the forefront of it, to be able to learn from our neighbors and our states and be able to create this in a system that makes sense for the provider in Alaska or the provider in Anchorage, and being able to make it work for this system in this state.
And Becky, as I understand it, the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association will implement this. Is that true? And if that's true, how tricky will that be?
This is really a partnership between the state, between the Hospital Association, and between the, I won't try to say the full name of your organization, ASEP is the name I know. So between the physicians. And so I think we will likely take a project management lead on this, but it's not that we are going to be making all the decisions about the project. We're just going to be helping to get the project organized and implemented. Obviously, you need the cooperation of hospitals, and you need the cooperation and support of emergency room physicians. And we feel very fortunate that we have emergency room physicians who want to do this, and we have hospital CEOs who are willing to step up to the plate and take on this project. I think another key element, though, is we've talked about shared savings, and that's in the bill as well. And I think that is a really important component as we are working to spend money ourselves that's going to save the state money. We think it's a really positive thing to be talking about how we can share savings, which really kind of helps us move down that payment reform path as well.
And have the specifics of that been worked out?
I think that's something that's just in a concept right now. And our first goal is going to be to implement the project. And then we need data. We need to look at the data and we need to demonstrate some savings. But this at least enables us to have that conversation. And I think that's a really, like I said, a good step for us as we talk about taking kind of some baby steps toward payment reform.
Okay, I want to sneak in one more caller here before we have to go. Francine is on the line from Anchorage. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Switching to psychiatric services of emergency rooms, my name is Francine Harbor. I'm the executive director of NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, in Anchorage. I don't know if this would pertain to the Valley at all, but we have a tremendous untapped resource of peer, P-E-E-R, trained people who have had a lived experience of recovery from mental health. And I know from 13 years of experience running consumer or peer support groups that if you connect someone who's headed to the psychiatric emergency room with a peer, more times than not, you can avoid that emergency room visit because basically as a peer, we know what to say to settle a person down and to get them to resources other than an emergency room. So I just am one. I've looked briefly at the Journal of Commerce article on the behavioral health section of Senate Bill 74, and of course there wasn't very much detail, but I would just like to know whether there's anything in this bill that would support, for example, groups like NAMI Anchorage that leverage volunteer peer services against the grant monies we
receive. Francine, let me see if the commissioner can respond quickly. We just have about 30 seconds. Commissioner Davidson, is that something you can respond to?
Sure. So in the bill, the bill requires the department along with the Alaska Mental Health Trust to be able to work on developing a comprehensive behavioral health system. And we would certainly be open to anything that improves the outcomes for Alaskans. And I think those conversations will be starting probably over the interim. And I would really encourage your participation. Through the health reform process, there was a lot of stakeholder engagement, and we anticipate more of that over the interim as well.
Okay, well, thank you so much to Health Commissioner Valerie Davidson, and thanks to KTOO in Juneau for hosting her there. We also had Becky Heltberg with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, Julie Taylor with Alaska Regional Hospital, and Dr. Ann Zink, an ER physician at Mat-Su Regional. I'm Annie Feit. Dave Waldron is our engineer, and Josh Edge was on the phones. Thank you.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
The Elder Mentor Program is seeking low-income seniors age 55 or older who have a passion for children and for sharing cultural values. Eligibility information at ruralcap.com. This message sponsored by Rural Alaska Community Action Program, Inc.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.